Is commercial real estate part of your portfolio? If not, you're overlooking a massive category of investable value. One estimate puts the value of all commercial real estate in the U.S. at somewhere between $14 trillion and $17 trillion. But how would you begin your analysis of this asset class? Well, listen to this episode of our podcast. That's how. Today, Adrian and Eric go all X-ray machine on you, revealing the nature and differences between office, industrial, retail, hospitality, multifamily residential, and more. We also explain why some of these categories are having a tougher time than others, as well as the various ways you can invest in one or another segment of this asset class in ways that match your situation and interests. Those ways include everything from buying a property yourself to being a passive investor in a private real estate fund. Just remember that though our conversation today is richly informational, it's not intended as investment advice. For that, talk with your advisor. And if you don't have one, or at least one you trust, well, give us a shout. Our contact information is at the show page. And now stay tuned as we explore all this and more right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Adrian Nicholson, and I'm joined by my other fellow co-host, Eric Olson. One of our other co-hosts, Roshan Lungani, is out today, but we're going to tackle the topic together. I'm really looking forward to today's episode. I'm glad I'm here with you, Eric.
Yeah, likewise, Adrian. I'm looking forward to this.
So today's topic we're going to touch on is commercial real estate. And this has been getting a lot of news coverage, and people are looking at this space, seeing is there opportunity here and what to really expect going forward. So Eric, do you want to touch on what we're going to be covering today?
Sure. And let me actually just start with why I think it's important. So most of our clients historically have thought about the way in which they build wealth and generate income primarily through stocks and bonds. And over time, there's been an increasing recognition of the role that other kinds of asset classes can play. And chief among them would be real estate, certainly not exclusively, but certainly real estate. In some cases, that could be owning it directly. But in other cases, people say, I don't think I have the expertise or the interest or the time to bother with that. Can I do it in such a way that I invest in real estate, but have somebody else do the work for me? Just in the same way as I don't need to run a company in order to have equity in my portfolio. Do I really need to run a real estate operation in order to have real estate in my portfolio? So the reason that we think this subject is important, though, is that obviously there's been, as you said, Adrian, a lot of news about what's going on in some headline sectors, chief among them offices, and what's taking place with especially in some of the largest urban areas of uncharacteristically high levels of vacancy, and even those units or those offices that are still officially still fully leased, you don't have as many people actually showing up to work there, and so the question then is, well, what happens when those leases have reached their end? Will they renew? Or if they will they renew at least with as much floor space? What does this do then to that entire sector? We're here to just talk about the fact that the commercial real estate sector is larger than that. And we'll talk about some areas that are less challenged or actually potentially fruitful areas for investors and some of the ways in which you can go about that, with the aim to try to help you have a broader view of how your portfolio could be diversified and how you could accomplish your financial goals. I will hasten to add that the things that we're talking about today, please don't, even if we're talking about the pros and cons of this or that, don't take those as a recommendation to just run out and start investing in this or start selling something else if it happens to be in your portfolio. This is something where you should have a conversation with your advisor. If you don't have an advisor, of course, that's what we do for a living. And you're certainly welcome to go to our website, retirementlifestyleshow.com, and track down our contact information and reach out. And we can certainly have that conversation with you. But this is really just for informational purposes. And we hope you'll find it worthwhile. Expect you well. All right, Adrian, with that, you want to get us started?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And let's just break down commercial real estate, because like you mentioned, sometimes when people hear that and seeing what's going on right now, they immediately think of office spaces. But commercial real estate has a number of different categories. I'll just list a few more other than office space. There's retail, industrial and warehouse, multifamily residential units, hospitality and hotels. So the categories can be very overwhelming sometimes, especially if you're researching this area to see what might be the best position as far as your portfolio. And each of these different subcategories in commercial real estate get impacted by different events, whether they're economic events, market, just interest rates, overall supply and demand of the economy, different cycles. They all get impacted differently. So I thought it'd be helpful just to break down these different subcategories and talk about how they're different and the risk that can be impacted with them as well. So the first one we talked about is office space, which you mentioned. A big issue with that right now is vacancy rates, and that impacts the overall rental income that these properties are receiving. So that's something people need to consider if they're looking for different opportunities to invest in. That's one of the big ones you can start off with as well.
Sure. Yeah, you know, the whole work from home phenomenon that grew out of the COVID pandemic has taken root in a lot of people's minds, and it's been a battle, hasn't it, to see what some corporate leaders are saying. Hey, that was fine for a while, but the reason it was working so well for a while is because we already had well-established, intact social connections between everybody. And so they were just, their work from home was an extension of those connections. But over a period of time, you don't have as much of that efficiency or the social lubrication that can facilitate those interactions and help teams reach better and faster decisions. And what we're seeing as corporate leaders is that is now, with new people coming into the business who've never had any of that other interaction, it's creating a setback. Meanwhile, those workers are saying, no, we rearranged our lives, don't you know? We moved to move out of the city, and we've moved farther away to cheaper housing or to a better quality of life. Don't make us come back. And so on this basis, I'm not sure exactly who's going to win this one. I know there are some of the things that you'll hear some voices saying, hey, it is going to come back. It's just going to take longer than we all expect. And others are saying, no, that's done. People are never coming back into the offices. I don't have a particular view about that. Adrian, do you?
I really don't have a particular view either, but it's something that you'll just have to watch over time, because there are benefits with working in an office. And then I understand some of the benefits of working from home. And like with investment, only time will really tell. And that's something that you really need to monitor if you're looking at this space for certain opportunities. The next one on my list that I mentioned was retail space.
Before you go to retail though, Adrian, can I say one more thing? And that is, when we're talking about what's taking place in the office real estate, commercial real estate, and in specifically in the office subsector, it's easy to find instances in which, oh boy, it has taken a toll. Many times it's more than just the work from home dynamic. It's also, there have been changing degrees of policy within some of the larger cities about the level of tolerance for homelessness. And at least this is what corporate leaders are saying, that lead them to say, hey, it's not just a matter of our work from home circumstances. It's now, honestly, that we're reluctant to have some of our employees be subjected to some of the conditions that have arisen in these cities that weren't here 5 years ago. And so when you look at, take San Francisco as a particularly difficult example of this, there's a building, I think it's 350 California, 350 California is the name of this building. Just a month ago, it reportedly sold for $60 million, changed hands at $60 million for this tower. That's 80% lower, if that price is correct, that's 80% lower than the price at which it changed hands just 4 years ago. So you're thinking, whoa, from 2019, a building that would have been at that point a $300 million transaction just took place at a $60 million transaction, $240 million of capital wiped out. That, you know, you're talking about a really difficult environment for some of these investors. People are literally, in some cases, the owners of these buildings are basically handing over the keys to the bank and saying, sorry, we just, there's no path forward for us here. It's pointless.
Yes, there have been some big valuation adjustments that are happening in this space as well. And that's where you're seeing investors looking for opportunity and seeing where they can get the best deals. And like you mentioned as well, when it comes to commercial real estate or just real estate in general, location is one of the significant factors that people need to look at when it comes to researching these different spaces.
There's a company called, if I recall correctly, Castle. And what they do is they're the makers of those key card systems that you'll have in these downtown offices that, you know, you unless you swipe your key card or your badge, you're not going to be able to get in the building. So what they're seeing is some, beyond the vacancy rates, they're seeing, which in depending on the city, what you're seeing is vacancy rates that might be 15, 20, 25, 30% in these offices. But what they're saying is even in the offices that are being, that are still under lease and where those leases are being paid, when we look at the number of badges that are coming in, we see only about 50% of what was envisioned to be the original, or at least of the badge holders, only around 50% on any given day are going to be in some of these buildings. Of course, different cities have higher, other cities have lower, but Chicago, of course, nearby is slightly more than 50%. So, and that's actually one of the stronger categories. So that then that begs the question, okay, when those leases reach their end, will they reset? Will they reset for the same amount of floor space? What will they do? And then is there another shoe to drop?
Yeah, that's a really good stat. Thanks for sharing that, Eric. So I'm going to move us on to the next subcategory we have in commercial real estate where people could find opportunity is the retail space. And like I mentioned before, location is a really important factor when it comes to looking for different investment opportunities, particularly with the retail space as well. And a significant risk too that people need to look out for this space as well is just rising e-commerce. As you know, a lot of this space has been impacted over time with people shopping online and looking for certain deals there, where that could have another bad impact on this space as well. Also, something to point out as well is tenant turnover as well. Are these properties being filled up and are they generating the income that they have projected? So turnover, location, and the rise of e-commerce are something people need to look at when they're researching the space.
Yeah, the retail apocalypse, if you will, was something that certainly predated COVID. And I know that, and you may know that as well, Adrian. Just all of us understand that from just the observation of what's taking place in some of the retail facilities around us and how much, you know, store vacancies there are. I was just driving last week over to this one restaurant, and on the way I was passing through this one giant mall that was built, I think it was in about 2000, if I recall correctly, about 2005 or 2006. And oh, store after store after store has, you know, a space available, space available, space available. But it certainly hasn't been helped by this. And again, especially in some of the urban areas where there's been at least a perceived change in the acceptability of you know, certain social or policies around retail theft and such, what you're seeing is a lot of retailers just saying the losses that we're incurring here just don't make sense for us. We weren't in business to, you know, have to try to manage these kinds of social dynamics. We were really just wanting to be a place where people could come in and see good goods and, you know, the nice things and then make that purchase. So if I go, for example, back to the Chicago example onto Michigan Avenue, and there's a stretch there that had sort of become famous as one of the more Tony shopping areas in the greater Chicago area. It's incredible just how much that has been hollowed out here over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. And that's having a significant impact on this sector as well. So thanks for pointing that out, Eric. The next category I have on here is industrial and warehouse spaces. And this sector really is driven by the supply and demand dynamics of the overall economy as well. That plays a significant role on whether or not these properties are generating a lot of income. So that's also something that people need to be aware of when they're looking at different investing opportunities right here, because if there is a significant slowdown in the economy or in the global economy in general, this different subcategory of commercial real estate will be impacted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if we just watch, for example, though it's a constantly shifting landscape there too, when everything was shut down on the services side in the wake of the COVID pandemic, one thing that people did is they said, okay, well, since I'm going to be locked at home, I'm going to start buying this or that book or this or that electronic gadget, or I'm going to do this or that sort of home improvement thing. And so what happened was a lot of cash flow started being redirected away from services and towards goods purchases and delivered goods purchases. And so what that did is it made warehouse owners suddenly had this magnificent, from their vantage point at least, growth of activity, and trying to just keep up with it itself was a challenge for many of them. But that category, generally speaking, if we look back to 2017 through 2022, and we look at where have been some of the best opportunities for commercial real estate investment, certainly industrial, broadly speaking, industrial and warehouse in particular, but industrial, broadly speaking, has been an enormously fruitful area for investment there.
So the next one I have on my list is multifamily residential. And this one in particular is impacted by location, demographic shifts, population growth, rental demand. That all gets baked into this category, and whether certain multifamily properties, duplexes, whatever it is in this category, is profitable from an investment standpoint as well.
Yeah, I think multifamily, a lot of people are wondering, hey, is it too good to be true? And maybe it is too good to be true. I mean, I'll acknowledge that there's some aspects of it that are potentially too good to be true. And it's not going to be the case that the sizzling growth of that sector necessarily is going to be supportable in every location, because you did mention location. But the dynamics of housing today are so different than they were back in 2005 and 2006. And that lead up, people, the builders were just going crazy with building, you know, on the outskirts of large urban areas, and expecting that the population shift out of the city centers into the suburbs was going to continue. And as we saw, a lot of them were left with a lot of property, a lot of unfinished developments and so forth, and got really burned by that. And as a result, have been much, much more cautious in the wake of the global financial crisis to engage in that kind of, you know, building spree. And as a result, even though we had tremendously low interest rates for a really long period of time then in the wake of that crisis, you nevertheless have seen millions and millions of units short of what would be, I guess, considered a balanced supply of housing with the increasing demand. And some people say, well, wait a second, wasn't it the case that all the millennials were living at home with their parents and just weren't? And well, maybe that was true, but now a lot of millennials are out there forming families and they're saying it's time for us to have a place to live. And so how are we going to do that? And with the housing shortages such as they are in many places, some of that's regulatory related, some of it's cautiousness about the builders and such. What you see is, at least of single family housing, an undersupply. So the response has been to say, okay, well, as an interim measure, if we can just build out multifamily and then provide people a place to live for a season until such a time as they amass whatever initial capital they'd need to make that purchase, then that could work. And I would say, depending on whom you ask, you're looking at somewhere between, I think the numbers I've seen have been anywhere between 3.5 and 6.5 million units shy of what would be considered equilibrium supply of housing for the demand that exists today. So I think that the multifamily category, along with industrial, as I've said already, is one of those areas where it is still fruitful. I think you have to be careful about where you do it. You have to know the dynamics. It really helps to have some driver of population inflows into an area. You have to also, you know, understand that the location indeed does have at a locale level a shortage of housing. It's one thing to observe this on a national basis. It's a different thing to see it at a local basis. But if you can see that there's a shortage of housing in a particular locality, and you can see the rationale for continued population influxes, and you can, especially if you can see housing prices really, really high, then I think that is, that's a strong context for a multifamily investment that can make sense.
Mm-hmm. And more on the multifamily side too, interest rates play a big role on how this different subcategory will perform in the future as well. With higher interest rates now, that does have a role on the impact of people looking for certain homes. So that's something too that people need to be aware of, seeing where interest rates are headed and how that can have an impact on this particular subcategory as well, because that's really just been shaking up the commercial real estate industry really as a whole, just where interest rates are right now and how that's impacting them across the board.
Did you have another sector?
Yeah, the last sector I have on here is hospitality and hotel. And this is a more of a cyclical where it's driven by peak seasons and depending on how much people are traveling. And you can say this, like the retail subcategory that I mentioned before, really can be impacted by how the overall economy is doing right now. And if there is a slowdown or a recession, whatever it may be, and people are going out less, spending less, traveling more, that could be an impact here as well. Or there could be more opportunities if this category has really experienced a lot of the valuation adjustments. It could be another area where people look at as well.
Oh, I agree with that. If you look at the typical, well, in fact, let's even take this, the hospitality section and or sector, and divide that into more leisure oriented, and on the other hand, more business oriented. Leisure, I think we can say, has come back to near or above pre-pandemic levels. It's the business category that has not had that same full recovery. And so in terms of thinking about, well, where might there be opportunities to find distressed assets that are still not fully, you know, fully, their vacancy levels are still pretty high, it might be, or at least higher than historically is has been the case, it might be in the business category. There again, though, the question becomes, has there been a fundamental change in the way in which business is being conducted? Is there fundamentally now going to be less travel in to the extent that potentially both, you know, the businesses in B2B settings are businesses saying, hey, we don't really need any longer to send someone physically to the location of a customer, and customers no longer are expecting or demanding that? Yeah, we don't. I just don't know the answer to that. I suspect it may be that at some point we all get a little tired of doing everything online, and that there is a reward to actually have physical presence together. But we'll see how that goes. It's interesting to see how a lot of these things work. It's interesting to see how a lot of these different dynamics work together. So since you led by talking about office. Office, with if you're having fewer people coming into city centers, then you also have less demand for both the lunchtime restaurant crowd, as well as, you know, the lunchtime or immediately after work, go get a beverage together with some of your coworkers, or go, you know, stop by the store or that sort of thing. So the what's taking place in the city center to offices has also then had an impact in restaurants, which is hospitality, and retail, which you discussed. And furthermore, especially in instances in which the cities are dependent to a potentially greater extent than is characteristic of their other city counterparts, they're more dependent on property tax revenues from business or taxes on business. To see all three of those things suffer, office, restaurants, and retail shopping, means that can put some pressure on some of these cities. And you know, depending on the city, there are some cities that have a lot of very, very strong base of their revenues that's coming from individual residential property tax revenues, but that's not always the case. And so, you know, just thinking about the dynamics, if you're looking at an investment in one place, it's worth exploring to what extent is the city itself fiscally sound and able, despite the downturn that maybe has occurred in some of these sectors, able to accomplish the various urban or you know, municipal goals that it might have. The reason I say that is that especially if you are one of those that would say, the conditions, I mean, just the actual safety conditions in some of these places where I might be inclined otherwise to want office space have now deteriorated to such a level that it's not appealing to me. You just have to ask, would the city, if they said, hey, maybe we went a little too far in this one direction in our leniency about some of these things, if they did make a swing back in the other direction, would they have the revenues to actually do that?
And also, too, we haven't touched on this part as well, which is a big role when it comes to commercial real estate and in these subcategories is employment. If employment still continues to be strong, that will help out most of these categories where over time, if people do start coming into the office or people have excess savings and are going out more, that will have a positive impact on this sector as well. But if it's the opposite, if the employment numbers begin to get worse, that could be something that people may want to consider as well when looking at this particular space.
Yeah. So, and one idea that's been floated, I'm sure people have raised it before, as they say, and particularly when they're thinking about a multifamily investment, I've heard this challenge issue. They say, hey, before I invest in multifamily, I'd sure like to understand whether or not the thesis for multifamily investing is going to be undermined by the following possible competition. And that would be converting urban offices into residences. If we have a housing shortage, we have an office, you know, excess supply, then why not just take those offices and convert them into condos or apartments? Hey, voila, problem solved. And so that's certainly an interesting possibility. And certainly in some cases it's happening. But what it's probably not as opportune as you might think at first glance. So which buildings are seeing the most interest for this conversion from office to housing or to condos and apartments? Well, it is those buildings that are a little bit older, a little bit shorter, and have a little bit smaller footprint. Why? Because people want windows. And so if you're thinking about it, you have a massive, you know, a footprint, but the same number of windows on that floor to satisfy a much larger footprint, then, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to have some condos inside that don't have a single window? Or are they going to make them really thin, you know, long condos where the back rooms have no view? So there's one consideration. A second consideration is then actually bringing in all of the necessary plumbing and electrical and natural gas and other sorts of things, and having that network throughout the building be sufficient to accommodate all of those condos. And what, again, they're finding is that, again, the taller, the broader, the newer the building, the less appealing that particular conversion is. So maybe there's some threat to the multifamily investing process that's, you know, buying a piece of raw dirt and then putting up a building. Maybe there's a threat to that. But I don't know yet that we've cracked the code on how to solve what at sort of first glance seems like an obviously appealing solution of converting all the offices or many of the vacant offices to residences.
Yeah, that will be something interesting to watch. Is there anything else you want to add on to this before we move on to the different ways you can invest in commercial real estate?
I guess there's maybe one other category that we haven't touched upon. Maybe it would be subsumed in the industrial, but it does stand alone a little bit, and that's storage. So most storage is today very fragmented, and it's more in a lot of mom and pops. Over time, what you've seen is some of the bigger aggregators of these things with their sharper branding, the visuals and the landscaping and everything. There's been the rise of some of those. But what's been an interesting turn there, and this is an instance again where there is perhaps a conversion opportunity, is to take retail locations and convert those into storage. In some cases, not all, but in some cases, it's cheaper to take, let's say, what's one of the big retailers that's gone, said, you know, we don't have an interest in any more retail presence. Let's say JCPenney. This is not an indictment of JCPenney. It's an observation about that. Or let's say a Sears or something like that, where they'll say, all right, well, we had this footprint, we had this big box, we had air conditioning, you know, we had the whole nine yards. We can do some superficial building inside that larger structure. And now we have climate controlled storage that for many people is the more attractive version of that. And it's located in precisely the places that people once shopped. So it's not as though it's far flung from where they otherwise would live. So there's maybe an opportunity there, Adrian, for the storage category to thrive. But by the way, storage in terms of which of the sectors is most resistant to downturns during economic downturns, it happens to be storage and multifamily.
Yes, that's a good one. Thanks for adding that onto the list as well, Eric. So now that we went over the subcategories, I got to imagine our listeners or viewers are like, okay, maybe that's a category I like, or that's one I'm going to stay away with. Now, what do I do? How can I look at different opportunities or where I can allocate my capital with? And I broke it down to four different ways you can invest in commercial real estate. And Eric, if there are any ones I'm missing or you think we should add, please just let me know. So the four I have on here is direct individual investment, real estate investment trusts, real estate funds, and private funds. So I have four.
All right. So yes, I would say those are the ones that come to mind for me. But let's make the distinction between your third and your fourth. What's that?
The third and the fourth. So a real estate fund versus the private fund, is that the one you're referring to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that will really particularly just depend on the type of company or different fund that you're looking at, where a real estate fund could be something like a mutual fund or just an individual company where they pull investing capital together to invest in different commercial real properties. And a private fund is offered by a private investment fund where they pretty much have some overlap.
Got it. Okay. I'm with you there. So yes. And you mentioned real estate investment trusts. Where would you like to start that exploration of those different vehicles?
So let's just start at the top of my list with the direct individual investment one. And this one tends to be the most complex one and has a lot of capital that is required as well and takes a lot of research, where you're looking for a property within the categories that we list in. You need to secure some type of financing to acquire the property as well. And then there's managing the property, having certain tenants and leases created, and then collecting rent. So this is why I have this one as one of the more complex ones, if this is the route that you want to go when you're looking at commercial real estate to invest in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how fruitful an area this can be. I have a few friends that are spending most of their time in real estate. And one friend I think this conversation with him was maybe a year to 18 months ago, had told me that he was selling his single family homes because he thought that that category was under enough pressure that he was concerned about price declines. Now, I'm not sure that what we've seen with some of the rents in the subsequent year, if he necessarily would say, looking back on that decision, that made so much sense to him. But I think he felt like, hey, these are ideally priced. I don't think I can expect further capital appreciation on them at that time. That's what he was saying at the time. But I do think that there's an opportunity for commercial real estate as opposed to residential real estate as an investment category that still has some legs. And so he was gradually then selling off the single family homes and then looking for office categories. And I think that's been on balance something he's been happy with. Another one of my friends, and I'm just out with him and his wife last weekend, has done that on a very large level. And so has 70 different tenants, and over time has really, you know, understood the space and how in a variety of commercial settings, with some better buildings and some less great buildings and so forth, has really mastered the dynamics of all of that. But for many people, they're thinking, well, I don't have that sort of strong background. How would I enter into this? And I'll just give you, this is a super quick tutorial, but I think there are various ways in which you can go about thinking about whether or not a potential commercial real estate purchase makes sense for you. But here's a super simplified way of thinking about this, is to first take what you're looking to try to arrive at an understanding of what net operating income would flow off of that property. And so how would you arrive at that? Well, you'd say, what do I have there to, that I would be able to lease out? And what amount of lease revenue would that command? So that's the revenue side, is the inflows from the leases. And you could approximate that by saying, maybe the building has, let's say, 3,000 square feet, and 20% of that is commons that you can't really lease out per se. It's hallways, bathrooms, storage closets, et cetera, utility rooms and whatever. But if, let's say, 80% of that, or 2,400 square feet, is leasable space, and you can do some, you know, checking on what similar quality space is commanding on a square foot basis in your area, and voila, you have an understanding of what your gross revenue might be if it were leased. You then need to adjust that by the fact that you'll probably have some vacancies from time to time. And right now, depending on where you are, you might think it's a prudent assumption to think about a larger or a higher vacancy rate, which then would suppress what your adjusted net operating, or your adjusted gross revenue would come down as a result of that. From that, you subtract what you pay in property taxes, and also what you'd pay in maintaining the building for those tenants. And that might be general, you know, maintenance like roofs and paint and such, carpets and cleaning, or whatever, you know, whatever sort of cost you'd incur. That gets you to your net operating income. And from that number, then you divide that number by what is known as the capitalization rate, meaning the what is the quote unquote yield that other comparable offices, or if it's industrial or whatever the space might be, retail, that whatever that category seems to be yielding in something known as a capitalization rate. Let's say it's 5%, 8%, 10%. Once upon a time, maybe a lot more, but historically, maybe about 8%, maybe now closer to 6 or 5 in some cases. Whatever that is, take that net operating income, divide by that cap rate, and that gives you an idea of what you could afford to pay for that building. And if you're thinking, well, it needs a lot of improvement to get it to that leasable level, then you need to think about offering less for that building so that you have a budget in place to be able to make the necessary improvements to bring it up to the requisite condition that would allow you to command those lease rates. So that's super, super simplifying it. And it's not quite that simple, but at least that's a way of thinking about how to price or gauge what a piece of property is worth. What I think you'll find is that right now there's a lot of stickiness in these prices, and a lot of owners of these properties have not yet come to grips with the fact that at this point their properties are probably not worth quite what they're thinking they are. So, you know, just have to, in some cases, hunt carefully and be patient.
And then, like you mentioned, running the numbers is extremely important, because seeing how much money you're expected to come in the door versus your costs and maintenance and upkeep, whatever it is something that's really going to drive whether this is a successful investment for you or not. So really great example. Thanks for sharing that, Eric. So the next one on my list was real estate investment trusts. And these are shares of a company, or you could get an exchange-traded fund of real estate investment trust to invest in as well. This really varies depending on what type of subcategory that we listed before you want to invest in, or if you want to invest across a lot of them. It really varies, and there are a lot of different ones out here, but this is a more simplified way of investing in commercial real estate. And it is subjected to market volatility as well. That's something that you have to consider, but compared to most of the other ones, this is the more liquid one when it comes to investing in this space.
Yeah, it's super liquid. I mean, it's in mutual funds, exchange traded funds, and so forth. And as you pointed out, there's different ways of, you know, different real estate investment trusts will have a different emphasis. In some cases, they are focused on being equity owners, and that's what they're after. In other cases, their focus is on, they're what are known as mortgage real estate investment trusts. What they're really after there is the inflows off of holding the debt. So the essentially being paid off of mortgage income. And the latter tends to have more in the way of income. The former tends to have more in the way of long-term at least growth. I'm not saying that you'll necessarily see right now. I'm not, again, echoing what I said earlier at the beginning of this podcast episode, don't take what we're saying here as a recommendation to rush out and then start pouring money into this or that REIT. We're just identifying that there are these different types. Some REITs will focus on certain subclasses. So for example, we've talked about one subset that will focus on healthcare facilities, or another that will focus on data centers, or another that will focus on offices and such. So it's useful to understand that just in the same way we've talked about sector diversification within the commercial real estate world, that the same is true and can be true, isn't always, but can be true with sometimes very specialized real estate investment trusts.
Yep, exactly right. Is there anything else you want to add on to this before I get into the third one?
Yeah, I guess I'll say one more thing is that real estate investment trusts are we use that label not because it's just a nickname for them, but it's just like an LLC or a C corporation or things like this. It's a statutorily permitted business structure that has tax advantages for owners of it. So I won't get into all the tax advantages right now, but it's a tax advantaged way to participate in that particular asset.
Awesome. Great. So the third one on my list is real estate funds. And these are commercial real estate funds that pull investors' capital together to invest in a particular commercial property. And these are run by certain management teams that handle the property selection, the acquisition, the overall management as well. These tend to be more illiquid, and some of them do have lockup periods as well. But this may give you an opportunity to be partner up with other investors to enhance your returns or seek that expertise from different management styles.
Yeah. So, and this isn't a commercial. It's just a statement of fact. The firm that you and I affiliate with, Adrian and Roshan as well, has made a sort of a distinctive commitment to what we'll call, I guess, modified endowment style investing. It's trying to democratize, if you will, the participation in some of these other these alternative asset classes in as a complement to the core portfolio being more conventionally allocated, as we've talked about many, many times in this show, to stocks and bonds and such. So with that, we have, you know, a lot of experience, I would say, comparatively to a lot of other advisors, with the good, bad, and the ugly of this particular space. And, you know, have some great successes that we can point to, and some scars and cigarette burns that we can point to as well. But what I would say is that in most cases, investors need to say, okay, what the crucial things I think they need to understand is, number one, if you're thinking about potentially investing in this category, what do we know about the operator? Has the operator done this consistently well before, or is it someone who says, I have this brilliant idea and I want to give it a shot? You know, that's not entirely fair, of course, to really talented newcomers to a category. I'm sorry, but it is that probably more of the scars and cigarette burns I mentioned a few minutes ago are stem from working with operators that don't have really mastery over something. And so finding operators who've been through various, you know, the good times and the bad times and have managed to deliver results for their investors is, I think, an important criteria to consider. A second, I would say, is know the sector. And that's why we spent a lot of time talking about that in this particular case. As it happens, a lot of the more dependable ones that we've seen over the years have been multifamily. I'm not saying the only ones, and I'm not saying all multifamily, but a lot, it's just a more dependable model because there's a, you know, it's a real asset. It's not a speculative idea. It's a real asset, real dirt, real buildings, real cash flows in most cases. And then the other thing is, okay, how long is it till an exit? You need to say, am I wired in such a way that if need be, I could be in this investment for 5 years? Or if there was potentially a market downturn in year 4 and 5, would I want to, you know, persist with this if the sponsor said, hey guys, we could sell them right now and get your, you know, get some return on the capital, but we'd be in a lot better shape if you'd give us a couple more years to wait this out and allow there to be recovery in this particular category. And so if, you know, you need to know that I don't need this capital for a while. And I think the fourth thing that I would say is recognize you're probably going to be confronted with K-1s, not 1099s. And so you need to have an accountant who's willing to do that with you, or if you do it yourself, you know, then you have to be willing to cope with that. And then I guess the last thing I would say is that you just need to understand that there's much more in any of these sorts of things. There's much more concentrated risk. The when you talked about those publicly traded real estate investment trusts, Adrian, those are usually having hundreds of properties, in some cases, potentially thousands of properties represented by multiple operators in some cases. In this case, you might be dealing with, you know, two, three, five, or even one project. And so the outcomes that you can have from this can be attractive if that one, you know, two, three, four, five, how many of our projects are underneath the hood work out well in that particular market environment. But by the same token, if they don't work out so well, you know, then you just have to be prepared to absorb that. So I would say this more about alternative investment generally, and not so much about this category alone, but that is, think about investing in alternatives as, and including in this sector as, what I'm going to do is, I don't know in advance which ones are going to work well. I have some expectations based on the strength of the operator's track record, but I don't know in advance which ones are going to work out well. Therefore, I will just fully expect that I'm doing this as one building block in a larger set of allocations. You know, maybe 2% of my portfolio to this and nine other things, each adding 2%. Now, I'm not prescribing this. I'm just using this as an example. So maybe now I have 20% of my portfolio in alternatives. If one of them blows up, I lost 2%. Okay, that's not going to derail my financial future. On the other hand, collectively, what I'm now having is an opportunity to have at least a portion of my portfolio participating in some of these different kinds of opportunities than the other 80% of my portfolio that's committed to just conventional stocks and bonds.
Yes, I mean, that's where the diversification aspect that you touched on in the beginning comes into play here. If this is something that fits your profile and you've looked at this particular real estate fund, whatever it may be, and they have a good track record, you like their investment strategy, that you've checked the fees as well, because the different fees for these different funds is going to vary and they're all different. That's definitely something else that people also should be aware about as well. But if that lines up, that could be something that could really help diversify your portfolio and provide that opportunity for you.
Mm-hmm. I'll say one more thing about this. Again, this kind of investment in private funds, whether it's in real estate or other asset classes, is not, I don't know that, I want to emphasize, this isn't for everybody. And in fact, I would say in many cases, the sponsors will say, you can't participate in this unless you're an accredited investor. In some cases, they'll be a little even more strict about it and say, you need to be what's known as a qualified client. And in some cases, they'll be even stricter still and say, you need to be a qualified purchaser. So they're trying to regulate, or at least have some measure of understanding of the sophistication of the investor's understanding and capacity to absorb a loss before they would say, you know, come on in and you can be part of this. The other thing, though, I would say, it's just in general in this area, it's not merely whether you're accredited or not. It's also based on your wiring. This is just the really wrong form of investing for some, you know, personality dispositions or, you know, this sort of thing. Don't feel like you are missing out, or don't feel like you're somehow less if you don't entertain these categories of investing through these private avenues. I would say go slow. And the final thing I'll say about the private category is that the position I take on this is that investors should have access to this without a commission. I'm not alone in that view, but I would say it is something of a rarity. And in most cases, what you'll find is you'll find that many, many advisors who offer these sorts of things do so in the framework of a commission. And their argument would be, hey, look, I'm not really making any, there's no advice that I'm bringing to you beyond the point of your investment. I have zero control over that any longer. So why should I continue to charge you an advisory fee for that? And I understand that, but my view is that in general, the client's internal rate of return on that investment will be higher if the advisor will do that on a fee basis, not on a commission basis. And in the final analysis, you don't want the question in the back of your mind, hey, did my advisor recommend that, if it's a commission-driven approach, did my advisor recommend that because he or she needs to make a boat payment? Or is this really instead sort of in my best interest? I think having it be fee-based, it produces a neutrality on the part of your advisor, enforces that neutrality on the part of your advisor to really ask, your advisor needs to ask the question, is this best for the client? That should be the only question. And if the answer is yes, then the advisor's compensation shouldn't change on the basis of the recommendation.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. Thanks for sharing that. It really just shows that there is a lot that really gets baked in here when it comes to looking at different opportunities within the commercial real estate sector, not only when it comes to investing, but the different subcategories that we covered as well today. We really wanted to give our viewers and listeners today an all-encompassing approach on this sector. If they believe that there's some opportunities here, or this is something that they believe would be a good way to help diversify their portfolio.
So true. Yeah, well, Adrian, we've had a great conversation. I don't have anything else to say today. Is there anything that you want to add before we conclude?
We covered everything on my list. I really appreciate all you listeners and viewers that tuned in today. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe. Tell your friends and family about our episode. We always love to hear your feedback. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through RHA Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither RHA Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of RHA Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through RHA Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and securities through RHA Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance, by Jason Shaw in Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.